My name is Amaya Jones, and this is the Arkansas Times Week in Review podcast for Friday, March 22nd, 2024. Thanks for joining us. Today, Benjamin Hardy and reporter Deborah Ann Shelton talk about a pair of recent stories pertaining to Jason Raper's appointment to the library board, as well as his desire to ban some books. And then they discuss news that former Governor Asa Hutchinson has some interest in becoming the next president of the University of Arkansas system. But first, on Tuesday, news broke of an ATF raid in West Little Rock in which the suspect opened fire on officers trying to serve a warrant. One of the officers was shot in the exchange of gunfire with the suspect, who was then shot by the officers. The suspect turned out to be Brian Malinowski, director of the Bill and Hillary Clinton International Airport, and he later died of his injuries. There are still lots of questions about exactly what happened. Here to tell us what we know are managing editor Benjamin Hardy and reporter Mary Hennigan.
So the news that's been on all of our minds this week, that sort of transfixed everybody around the office for the past several days, has been the shooting that occurred in West Little Rock at a residence early Tuesday morning. And we got this news from, I think it was first from the Arkansas State Police. We got notice of there had been an officer-involved shooting, which is not, you know, not an everyday occurrence, but not super unusual to get a press release from the state police saying that. But then the name on the press release, you know, kind of jumped out at folks, and that was Brian Malinowski. He's the executive director, or was the executive director, of the Bill and Hillary Clinton National Airport here in Little Rock. He's been there in that top role since, I believe, 2019, and had worked there for some years before that as well. Pretty low-key figure, well-paid executive as far as Little Rock City salaries go, but not somebody that you heard a lot about. And then he was shot by federal agents in this exchange of gunfire Tuesday morning. So it kind of left everybody stunned. And then we heard, got a press release later on. Reporter Mary Hennigan, who I'm talking to you today, got in touch with the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. And they kind of said that he had shot first, that they had attempted to serve a warrant at 6 a.m. and that he opened fire on ATF agents. They returned fire, and he was wounded and taken to the hospital. Brian Malinowski died on Thursday, I believe. It appears the wounds he sustained during the firefight were, very severe, and he was on life support ever since then, and was taken off life support finally on Thursday. But let's go back first to Tuesday afternoon, and Mary, who's our city reporter, drove out there to see what was going on.
Yes, that's right, Benji. So on Tuesday afternoon around 4 o'clock, I'd say, we decided that I should go out and and check the ground, see what was going on. So I pulled in. It seems like a well-off neighborhood in West Little Rock. It's at 4 Durant's Court.
Thank you.
And it's in a small, I would say small neighborhood off of Highway 10.
Yeah.
So I pulled up to the scene, and there were lots of emergency vehicles. I actually parked behind a fire vehicle that was hauling a raft, which I thought was really strange because we were definitely not near any water. There were two larger fire trucks and a Little Rock police car there as well. And the Little Rock police were blocking off the crime scene, which started at the beginning of Malinowski's cul-de-sac. So anything that I could see was from quite a distance away. Malinowski's house was tucked in behind several other houses. The view was pretty much zero, but what I could see was ATF officers removing items from Malinowski's house. So I was there for about an hour before this happened. So around 5 p.m. on Tuesday, officers began pulling guns and what looked at the time to be ammunition boxes and gun cases. We later found out that that was accurate. They removed several guns, dozens of guns, from Malinowski's residence on Tuesday, and they packed them up into a U-Haul and noted them later.
Got it. And I think the fire department was also bringing some saws and pry bars inside the house too, right?
That's right. So I talked with some neighbors while I was out there as well, and they had told me that they initially saw the fire crew bringing in large pry bars and saws, and then I later saw them removing them from the home. So what everyone thought was that they were trying to open a safe.
Yeah.
And in the documents, we would later find out that there was at least one vault listed. We can assume that they did open a safe of some kind and removed items from there.
So, what did you talk to the neighbors at all? What did they say about like their thoughts on what happened.
Yeah, you described Malinowski as kind of this private guy, and that was also what I heard from the neighbors as well. I spoke with someone who lived kind of catty-corner to the cul-de-sac, and they were, you know, pretty good friends with the Malinowski family. They had delivered some food as neighborly activities. Uh-huh. Those things happen. Uh-huh. Been to each other's houses. And they said, for the most part, that Malinowski is a private guy. Didn't get to talking much unless guns were involved. He was a well-known gun enthusiast to the neighbors that I spoke with. And that is something, you know, that now makes sense.
Right. Right. Yeah, to say the least.
So I left at about 6 p.m. on Tuesday and came back and, you know, wrote the story up, and then we waited and we waited and we waited some more on Wednesday to find out if we could, if anyone would tell us about the search warrant, because we knew that the federal agents were serving Malinowski, but we didn't know for what reason and what kind of search warrant it was. And on Wednesday, we heard nothing.
Right.
For most of Thursday, we also heard nothing. But then on late afternoon, some court documents came out. So Benji, why don't you tell us what happened on Thursday?
Yeah, right. You know, and we do not want to sort of fuel rumor or conspiracy theories, but it's worth like noting just kind of how much people were chattering about this, like during the silence from authorities, like during the, you know, 48 hours plus when there was no statement at all from the ATF or the U.S. Attorney's Office or the state police. Naturally, there was a lot of speculation about, does this connect to his job at the airport in some way? You know, what's going on there? Like, I mean, TSA, obviously, you know, they're like screening for guns. I mean, stuff's coming in and out of the airport all the time. Like, it just makes you wonder. I mean, whenever the documents did arrive, like whenever they were unsealed late Thursday afternoon, that was not really the case. Initially, we were told they were coming by Bud Cummins, who is a lawyer, well-known, former U.S. attorney, connections with the Huckabees, and he's sort of a well-known guy. He was serving as a spokesman for the Malinowski family, which clearly has some major questions about this whole operation. He said that, you know, he was sort of working to get the documents unsealed. And they were unsealed finally late in the afternoon. And, I mean, basically what they describe is a lot of gun purchases, I think 150 over the course of several years.
I think about 2 years for that 150 number.
And then a lot of sales. I don't know if there's ever a number mentioned there, but he was selling lots of guns as well, both at gun shows and then outside of gun shows to private parties.
So, but buying and selling guns isn't illegal and not in Arkansas. So what does the affidavit say about what Malinowski did wrong?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. I mean, we even spent a little time like kind of going over that ourselves, but I mean, gun laws are really complicated, and it's true that as a private individual, you can buy and sell guns, but you are supposed to not be dealing them. I mean, you're when he was buying these guns, he bought them. I mean, well, we don't know if he bought them under the table too, but the ones detailed in the affidavit, you know, they're all not under the table sales. You know, they're all sales for which he filled out a form, a federal form. But that on that form, you sort of attest saying that this gun is, I'm going to use it, you know, myself.
And you don't have the intention to sell it to someone else, right?
Right. But, I mean, that said, I think everybody knows that this does happen all the time. I mean, this is like kind of what the gun show loophole is.
Sure.
People at gun shows, a lot of them are de facto dealers, you know, and they're saying they're private individuals, but they are, you know, buying guns clearly with the intent to sell them. But, you know, nonetheless, he was, you know, saying he was, you know, on this federal form saying that he was not intending to sell them. And that clearly was not the case. And then the other thing is that caught the ATF's attention is some of these guns ended up in the hands of people that should not have them.
So do you mean that the guns were found like at the scene of crimes?
Yes. It says that the affidavit says that six guns that passed through Malinowski's hands were known to have been recovered in the commission of a crime. Though some of those crimes it mentions, and they're pretty minor. I mean, they're like marijuana possession offenses. So it's not exactly like, in the affidavit at least, it's describing like these were guns that were used to commit homicides. That's, again, what is said in the affidavit. It seems like he first came to the attention of the ATF when a gun was recovered in Canada. And, you know, Canada has much stricter gun laws than the U.S. The serial number on that gun traced back to a purchase that Malinowski had made. And that's sort of why they began looking into him. Mm-hmm. And then they began tailing him. They began sort of surveying him. And at one point, undercover agents bought some guns from him at a gun show. There was also a confidential informant that was, you know, the ATF had make a purchase from him. And, you know, this, all this is sort of establishing that he was effectively acting as a dealer.
Right. And I think that there is a part in the affidavit where it says that one agent recognized him out in the world as being part of another investigation.
Right. Yeah. The agent said that from a different unrelated investigation. And we don't quite know what's going on there.
Interesting. But at least three guns were sold to ATF agents, correct?
Right.
Where do we go next? How do we know if the Tuesday morning shooting is justified?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, again, like some of the speculation that was swirling this week is like, oh, he's, you know, he must have been involved in some sort of, you know, really heinous crimes. And that, you know, we could still find out more that we don't know about. But as of now, you know, the behavior that it describes is not, like, I would say, extremely shocking, again, for a very gun-friendly state like Arkansas. And so that does raise some questions about, like, how this whole raid was handled. It was at 6 a.m. Agents came to his house. As we said earlier, the ATF has said that he shot first, and we're going to have to get more details about, after the investigation, about what exactly happened here, the sort of sequence of events. I mean, that's really, I think, the big mystery right now is, like, federal agents come to your door, you open fire on them. Like, at what point did that happen, and what did the officers do to announce themselves?
That's right. So without knowing if it was a no-knock warrant or an announce and enter warrant, we don't know where the shooting took place, who opened the door, really anything about the shooting except for that there was one.
Right. And we should also mention there was an ATF agent who was wounded in the exchange of gunfire. So Malinowski did strike one of the agents, but that person has been released from the hospital and has, you know, non-life-threatening injuries.
Next, Minji talked to Deborah Hell Shelton about a pair of recent stories. First, on Tuesday, Deborah reported that Jason Rapert, who was appointed to the State Library Board in December by the Senate Rules Committee, asked for the head of the Arkansas Library to email state-funded libraries to ask if they own or have owned 30 specific titles. This came after a previous attempt in February to defund libraries that were currently in litigation against the state for new rules in Act 372. After that, Deborah and Benji talk about former Governor Asa Hutchinson's desire to be appointed to the head of the University of Arkansas.
So, Deborah, I wanted to ask you about a couple of stories this week. You had several great stories this week. The first thing is early in the week, you reported on really a follow-up to something we've been following with the Arkansas State Library and the State Library Board. So this goes back to the appointment of former State Senator Jason Rapert of Conway to the State Library Board. That's an appointment that the governor made, Governor Sarah Sanders made. It was controversial at the time. Everybody kind of expected Rapert to start using that position to do his normal culture war thing, and he did not disappoint with that.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, take us back. So at the first Library Board meeting in which he was a member, he kind of raised a fuss and then made a request after that meeting, right?
Okay. Yes. First, he proposed cutting off funding, state funding, to any public library that dared to sue the state. Well, forget whether that's even constitutional. It's just like, you know, sheer retribution. And no one would even, not even Sarah Huckabee Sanders' other appointee to the board, would second that motion.
Yeah.
And so it died. There was a little discussion, but not a lot. I think it took most of the members by surprise. Then he said something to the effect that he had expected that. Then he, later in the meeting, he asked if he could send a list of books and find out if publicly funded libraries in the state have or have had those books. And the library director said, you know, you can. And so he did do that. And he attached a list of 30 books, all, you know, wanting to know if any of these 30 were in the library's possession and available to people 18 or younger than 18.
And so then he sent that request to a staff member, to State Library Director Jennifer Chilcote. And then...
Correct.
And so she's kind of placed in this difficult position because, you know, she's not a political appointee. She's a staff person, but you have this board member who's requesting that she, you know, carry out this task. So she doesn't really have a lot of choice. And
right.
And then on March 12th, it seems that she sent out an email to various library systems around the state. So
yes, and when I checked on this early this week, she hadn't gotten some of the requests back. She gave them to a little later in April. She had not received all of the requests yet. And she also told them that they could voluntarily reply.
Right.
Hal Raper will react to that, to the ones, if any, that end up not replying. I don't know. He may insist that they answer. But the board only meets quarterly, so we may not hear a lot unless it's through email or something like that before then. But of the boards, of the libraries that had responded earlier, none of them had refused to reply.
Also, I mean, so what are the sorts of titles that are on this list of 30 offending books?
As you might expect, the list targets, for one thing, books about the transgender community. I'm looking at the list now. The first one on the list is This Book is Gay. Another one is All Boys Aren't Blue. Those are two of those that are aimed at the transgender community.
I think, you know, those are some of the titles that have been popping up at similar, you know.
Yeah, Gender Queer is one.
And, like all around the country, you know, school boards or library boards, like where this has become sort of a culture war flashpoint, those are some of the ones, the books that have been like kind of targeted.
Right.
Especially.
And he also includes books such as, I'm forgetting which one it was, but it may be about abuse. And yes, it may be somewhat graphic, but think about it. If it's about a child or a teenager being abused, whether physically raped or emotionally abused, learning how to deal with that and knowing that you're not the only one who's been through that.
Right.
And learning all that through reading could actually be helpful to a child. These things are not saying this is a good thing, go out and do them, you
right.
know.
Right.
They're
yeah.
putting about people who have dealt with these things or people who are members of community that just happens to be different from the, you know, the heterosexual norm in this country.
You know, it also seems, as you and others have pointed out, I mean, there's obviously all sorts of books that contain sex and violence and all sorts of things that people might find objectionable. Mm-hmm. This just seems to be like sort of a narrow list of specific things that, for one reason or another, have ended up on the crosshairs of this of
right.
would-be censors.
One author that shows up on here is Ellen Hopkins, and she's apparently very popular with young people. Several of her books are listed here. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 books at least on this out of 30.
And I think he also, did he leave the door open to possibly adding to that list in the future?
Oh, yes. And in fact, as I recall, during the meeting, he said something like, for starters, you know.
Yeah.
And he'd like to start with this. And there are books that, you know, have even been targeted in other communities that aren't on this list. And I'm like 99% sure that he'll come back with more books. And I'm not so sure he and others won't later be targeting books aimed at adults, you know. But for now, they're going with those younger than 18, and they've started with a list of 30, but I would wager it's going to get bigger.
Okay, well, we will see how libraries respond to that request and what Raper says in response. Let's move on to another story that you worked on this week. So rumors have been circulating this week, partly through Democrat Gazette columnist John Brummett, about former Governor Asa Hutchinson potentially having some interest in a position with the U of A system at the top of the University of Arkansas system, in fact. So who is in that position right now? Who is the U of A system president?
Yes. Donald Bobbitt is the president of the UA system, and he has been for several years. Seems in the past year or two, he's encountered a lot of controversy. First, there was controversy over the person he wanted to be chancellor of the Fayetteville campus.
Right.
Then last year, another company was set up to buy the University of Phoenix. And that's, of course, the for-profit university that is always advertising on TV and has been right. still trying to find a buyer.
Online university, right?
Yes, online yeah. university. And, well, the main problem, not in addition to the idea not being real popular with a lot of people, he did so in almost total secrecy for around 18 months. And the secrecy, as much as the idea of trying to buy Phoenix, is what turned a lot of people off, including some board members. And so with all that, there began to be concerns or questions about his contract. Well, the board ended up approving his contract.
Some board members were not too enthused about him, right? Like that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. One of them, Sheffield Nelson, basically said, I'm going to forego being chairman in the coming year of the board because I would have to work with Dr. Bobbitt a lot and I can't deal with that.
Right.
And I'm sure Bobbitt was happy to hear that. That said, and it wasn't just him. There are a couple less vocal members. They're not as vocal or well-known as Sheffield Nelson, but they were concerned too.
Sure.
And they, one of them mentioned at the board at a board meeting how little he'd been told about all this, you know. And the other one never really said anything other than to vote against it. And even I think a couple of the members who might have been swayed one way or the other were just kind of turned off by the secrecy, you know.
Sure. And then when they finally did renew his contract, it was under some terms where it seems like they can sort of potentially move him out the door if they so chose, right?
Yes, they can get rid of him now with 90 days notice, and they don't have to have like cause, as it's called in legal documents. Now it can just be for convenience.
Huh.
Well, that could be just that we'd like to hire Asa Hutchinson or someone else,
sure.
you know. And now they have to pay, give him 90 days notice, and I presume they could just pay him 90 days. And on top of that, they would have to allow him, if he wanted, to become a tenured professor. They wouldn't have to buy out his whole contract or a big chunk of it. Plus, the contract was relatively short compared to his previous one. This one, I think, only goes into January 2026, I believe.
Right.
Which is, you know, contracts that these big institutions go, that's not all that long. And
it wouldn't be super surprising if we saw Donald Bobbitt make an exit at the U of A system in the,
right.
you know, for many of us, I mean, the idea of Asa Hutchinson stepping into that role was not on people's radar. I mean, Asa was, you know, just a few months ago, he was still campaigning for president, for the Republican presidential
exactly.
nomination.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it sounds like he is now, yeah. I mean, what have you found out this week about how seriously he's taking that?
Yeah, well, Sheffield Nelson, I just called him because I know he will talk more than some trustees, you know.
Right.
And, of course, he's dealt with the public for years. But anyway, I called him just kind of on a whim to see if he would talk about it. And he said, yeah, that Asa had called him just within the past 2 weeks. And he said, you know, basically that he was interested in it. And now I'm not saying he would agree to any terms. And Sheffield Nelson never really said, I will vote for him
yeah.
or against him. But he did say that he thought Asa would be a good person to talk to, you know, about the job. And you have to remember, of course, as someone else pointed out to me, that apparently the Hutchinsons and the Huckabee Sanders aren't exactly pals. And so whether the current governor, would be happy with this. I don't know. But the school, the university boards were independent of the governor. Yeah, she appoints them now, so right. She could just get even by not reappointing one. But technically, they can choose the president they want.
Yeah, I mean, I think, in fact, that if I recall, that goes back to some of the stuff we've been seeing with the corrections board and the independence of certain state boards. There's a guarantee in the Constitution through an amendment that the U of A system board, the trustees are, do have a fair amount of independence, replaced at will. But
yeah. Now, Hutchinson appointed 8 of the current 10 trustees. Hmm. 2 of them were Sanders appointees. I would mention, though, that one of those 2 appointees did not support Bobbitt's Phoenix effort and kind of was on the more conservative side on that vote. Sanders never made her position on it clear.
On Phoenix, you mean?
Yeah, on Phoenix. Kelly Eichler, who worked for her at that time, liked it but recused. So we don't really know to this day what Sanders' position, if any, was.
And you weren't able to talk to Asa himself, correct?
No, unlike Brummett, I don't know how to. I don't have his phone number.
Yeah,
but he's on Twitter, and he's made comments about different topics, but naturally hasn't mentioned that one. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. I was talking to one person who mentioned his background, is not in education.
Right.
I mean, he's well educated, but that's not his background.
Yeah, he spent his career, law and in
government. Yeah,
career
government guy. And this person mentioned that if we look at his resume, we see his bachelor's degree was from Bob Jones University.
Right.
Well, that's not going to go. Of course, I don't even know. I doubt many kids even have heard of Bob Jones. But it's, I don't think that would be controversial at this stage in Hutchinson's career. But it's just he doesn't really have the background you would expect.
He's not an academic. And
no.
And you also pointed out, I mean, he's 73 years old. He's not somebody who's going to be there for 20 years.
Yeah. And Bobbitt is, I believe, 67. Well, it was, there was already some thought, well, Bobbitt could retire. Okay, Bobbitt, so we're going to replace him with someone older?
Right.
That doesn't really, the retirement issue wouldn't be a good thing to broach to Bobbitt if you're going to hire Hutchinson.
Okay, well, let's leave it there. We'll just have to see what, if anything, develops. But very interesting reporting. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
And that's where we leave you today. Thanks for listening to the Arkansas Times Week in Review podcast. We'll see you next week.